So I had some good news in the flight down from Penang this afternoon. I was looking at the in-flight magazine, and I found some very important information. There's a study done in the University of Colorado that now shows that if you're just holding a cup of coffee, then you think kinder thoughts. That's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah, scientifically proven now. Just hold, not even drinking it yet, just holding it, and then you think kinder thoughts about people. So that's good. So that's, I'm going to quote that one often in my Dhamma talks from now on. Okay, so the talk tonight is on managing change. And of course, you know, like, there's one of my favorite sayings by, you know, by the physicist Niels Bohr, and he said that the difference between a shallow truth and a profound truth is this. The opposite of a shallow truth is a falsehood. Okay? But the opposite of a profound truth is another profound truth. Yeah, that's very true. So in this case, this is also true, because when we say we're giving a talk about managing change, of course the implication is that change is a problem. Yeah, right. Otherwise we wouldn't have to worry about managing it. Yeah, so change is a problem. But also it's true that that stillness is a problem. Yeah, lack of change is a problem. Yeah. So it depends on where we want to look at. Actually, we are animals. Right? Well, I am anyway. I don't know about you guys, but animals, and animals means animated, doesn't it? Yeah? So it means our nature is change, yeah? As opposed to plants. Plants are planted, right? They stay where they are. They move very, very slowly, yeah? Animals are animated. Yeah? You see animals, are always moving. Yeah? Even if you put them in a cage or something like that, they're always moving. So for us, movement is normal and stillness is a bit weird, which we always find out if we try to meditate, yeah? You sit for meditation for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and we begin to realize how difficult it is to keep our body still. So, when we look at the world around us these days, it seems that we get the impression that change is happening faster and faster and faster, and I think it's, you know, no doubt true that that is the case, yeah, that change is happening faster now than it ever has before on a social level. And read in the you know, the paper the other day about a woman who died, I think, 115. Yeah, so the world's oldest woman died 115. Think about that, 115 years, and all of the things that you've seen, you know, the whole 20th century. Yeah, you've evolved from horses and carts, you know, the first car, the first aeroplane, all of these things, all of the wars, all of the technology, all of the social changes, and now the challenges of global warming and so on. Incredible change. Whereas for most people, most of the time, actually, there's an incredible continuity in human culture as well. For example, one of my interests is in ancient Indian culture, and the oldest Indian culture we know of is the Harappan culture, which is around 2000 BC. And, you know, we know about Harappan culture because of some implements and some drawings and inscriptions and so on. And it's quite fascinating because you can see the same technologies that are used on these Harappan inscriptions. This is in the area of Pakistan and northwestern India there. And you can see people using the same technology today. Yeah? Plowing their fields in the same way, using the same animals, yeah? Same kinds of things they're doing. That's 2,000 years. So in some ways, things don't change. And I remember one time I was having breakfast in Perth with Ajahn Brahm, and at that time they had an Englishman was the caretaker of the centre there, and he came and offered breakfast for us. You know, and of course when you had two Englishmen together, they start talking about home and start talking about England and so on. And they said, oh, you know, English people don't like to travel. You know, like you travel just a few miles down the road and you come to another town and they'll say, where are you from? And you say, you know, you're from the other town. They say, oh, I haven't been down there for years. You know, what's it like down there? And so on. And so they were talking about this and sort of laughing about how little Englishmen like to travel. And then the caretaker had an English newspaper. And so I opened it up and read it, and they had an article about this peat bog man. Yeah, so you know they dig the old corpses out of the peat bogs in England and other places. And it's very well preserved and so on. And this one was so well preserved they managed to do a DNA test on him. Yeah? And then they did a DNA test on all the villages in the village nearby where he was found. Yeah? So this peat bog man was like 2000 BC or 4000 BC or something. And they found that he had shared the same DNA with one of the men in the village who was alive today. So his family hadn't moved in 4,000 years. And the fellow was a history teacher. Right? And more than that, the peat bog man had some kind of wind instrument, like a bone thing, like a trumpet or flute or something. And his descendant was still a flute player. Yeah? So how's that for continuity, yeah? 4,000 years and hasn't left the village. So, you know, and even that is, there's, you know, even more chain, more continuity in say, in Australian culture. You have the Aboriginal culture or cultures, you know, they've been there for 30,000 years or 40,000 years, you know, the unbroken cultural lineage. I mean, of course, it's changed very slowly over that time, but not the kind of radical developments that we've seen. So this is, you know, a kind of a norm in human culture is that often things are very slow to change. And yet here we are in this society which seems to love change. We always want everything to be new, to be the best and so on. Next generation's everything is always better than last generation's. And, you know, even though we know that actually it's just a con, yeah? We know that the things we used last year, they're still fine, yeah? And that people just want to sell us things for next year. I was just in Penang, just staying with a man who works in IT and sort of develop digital gadgets and things like that. And he says that their aim is to develop their digital gadgets that will kind of self-destruct after 2.5 years, right? So they try to design it so that something will break down after 2.5 years. And because you get a new one, you see, and it's useful for both the consumer and the producer, because the consumer, when it breaks down after 2.5 years, is secretly happy, right? Because they really want to get the new shinier model, right? But they find it hard to justify it. But when the old one breaks down, it's cheaper to get a new one than it is to buy the parts. Yeah, isn't that what you say? And so actually you're really quite excited to go down to the shop and see what they've got for a new one. You can get a better one. So this is how we have been trained to think. But also there's the flip side of that, isn't there? The flip side is that change is also stressful, right? It is, and it's we're continually having to learn things, you know, which become very complicated. You know, you think of all the things that are complicated, like, I don't know, like telephones. You know, like when I was growing up, there was one telephone company, and you had a phone, and you went ding, 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 like that, and you rang someone. That's all there was to it. It was very simple. You had a phone book. Now, there's so many different plans. You know, you've got VoIP, and you've got mobile, and you've got all of these kinds of things. And it's stressful, you know, you always think you're doing something wrong. Right? You always think you should be on another plan, you should be with another provider, your friend's got a better deal than you are, you're paying too much, and so you've got to keep on shopping around, you've got to keep on putting time and effort into it, yeah? Just so you can call people up. So life definitely is becoming more complicated, it's becoming more stressful, so we have to learn how to deal with that. And so thankfully, in Buddhism, change is not is not an option, right? And change is nothing unusual, change is actually the essence. Sabbe dhamma, sabbe sankhara anicca. All conditioned things are impermanent. The Buddha taught again and again and again and again. All conditioned things are impermanent. So we have this kind of dual attitude or ambiguous perspective on change. On the one hand, we know that things need to be renewed, and we love things that are new. We love seeing the new plants growing up. Yeah, we love it when there are babies who are born. Yeah, we love things that are new and fresh and young. We get to see them growing up and so on. But also, the change brings with it a sense of stress and a sense of fear. And the kind of hurtling into the future, more we have this feeling of hurtling more and more into the future. And it's interesting when you compare, if you look at fear, the kinds of fears which people have. Even when I was in Thailand, when I first started reading Dhamma books, and I would read about the forest Ajahns. I don't know if you've read the stories of forest monks, you know, Ajahn Man and Ajahn Chah and so on. And when they would tell about their lives and their spiritual practice, they'd always have three essential ingredients. Okay, so if you read the biographies of the great forest Ajahns, there's three things that must be included in every biography of a forest Ajahn, and they're the things which they were scared of the most. One of them is a tiger, right? So every story you've got to have an encounter with a tiger. Second one, ghosts, all right? It's got to be a ghost story in there somewhere. And the third one, the most terrible, terrifying, frightening of them all, is the meeting with the wife from the previous life. So the three most fearful things for the forest Ajahns. Yeah. So you can have those three things in there. And I remember kind of looking at those things, and you know, and they always stress that, you know, in your practice, you should not try to run away from your fears. You should be there and face up to them. And there are all these very kind of dramatic stories of, you know, meetings with tigers in the forest in the middle of the night and so on. And I remember thinking about this and thinking, well, what do we do? How do we get the advantage of that kind of practice? We don't have tigers. Yeah, even if you're in the forest monasteries in Thailand, it's very rare that you see any tigers these days. Ghosts, well, I don't know. I've been living in the forests and, you know, often living in cemeteries and things like that for 15 years. And I just don't have enough baramis to be able to see any ghosts. I really wish one day, I'd really love to see something funny, but I've never seen anything. So I don't know, I just don't have enough merit. I keep on practicing. There was one monk in the monastery I stayed at Wat Nanachan in Thailand is absolutely stiff with ghosts. Right? It's an old cemetery, and they burn all the bodies in the middle of the monastery, quite literally. That's often why they establish monasteries there, because it's the only place where the villagers won't go, right? And they leave some patch of forest around there because it's all full of ghosts. So there's so many ghost stories there in that monastery. And some very kind of mild ones and some very terrifying ones. One of the places, anyway, you're not interested in ghost stories, so I won't go on about that. But anyway, there was one monk there who also really wanted to hear a ghost, to experience a ghost. He was a Malaysian monk, actually, as it happened. And so he used to do these kind of invocations to call up ghosts and things like that. And one day he did. He was terrified, ran screaming through the forest. His friend's place wouldn't go back to his kuti. So, yeah, you have to watch out what you call up for. So I haven't met any tigers. I haven't met any ghosts. Right? Now, as for the wives from a previous lifetime, I don't know. Seems to have been reasonably safe so far. Anyway, maybe I just haven't met her yet. So what is our fear? Yeah, and so these are very primal things. Yeah, they're very primal, and it seems to me that in our life, you know, we live a life of greater kind of material prosperity and security, so we don't have such primal fears. You know, we have terrorism. I don't really like terrorism. Is great. It's kind of this big, terrible fear. Yeah, that we have. Look, I'd just like to ask a question. Did any of you see any terrorists on the way to the Buddhist Society today? No kind of masked figures huddling on the street corners with bombs or anything like that? No. I've never actually seen a terrorist, by the way. In my whole life, I've never seen anyone. I don't even know if I've ever met anybody who's ever seen a terrorist. Yeah? You're more likely to be hit by lightning than you are to die by terrorism, right? That's quite true. That's a literal fact in most countries of the world. So terror, the acts of the terrorists, of course, are very, they do these awful things and kill people and so on, but our response to it is entirely disproportionate, yeah? And by our completely excessive response to their acts, of course, we're playing their game. That's exactly what they want us to do. That's why they're terrorists. Their aim is to induce terror. And by feeling terror and by responding out of fear, we're handing them their victory on their platter. That's all they want, to create fear. That's why they're terrorists. But that's a very abstract kind of notion, isn't it? Something we've learnt from the media and the news and things like that. But it's not a reality of our lives. Yeah? So I think our fears, and then the other fears that we face, there's more, even more, I think, endemic fears or more subtle fears that we have underneath. We're concerned about the environment breaking down, yeah? We're concerned about resources running out. We're concerned about the inequality in the world and the unrest in so many parts of the world that seems ready to flare up. We're concerned about, say, a country like Pakistan, which seems to be so unstable, and yet they've got the bomb. Yeah? I think that's a very fearful thing. What's going to happen when the oil runs out? So there's many things that we have actually which are, genuine dangers, genuine threats. These things are all very real. And yet they manifest in our psyche in terms of some kind of sort of unease, which comes out in many irrational ways. So one of my favorites these days is the 2012 conspiracies. I keep hearing so much about it. Everyone keeps on telling me that the world's going to end in 2012 because of these Mayan prophecies and things like that. Oh, yeah. Actually, just for your information, the Mayans never made any prophecies, okay? There's not a single inscription anywhere of any prophecies made by Mayans, okay? So if anyone tells you there's Mayan prophecies, the world's going to end in 2012, don't believe them. Of course, I'm sure there'll be a lot of bad things happen in 2012, right? But it won't be anything to do with the Mayans. But what that's telling us is that we have somehow have a need, yeah, the fears, the things that are happening are quite genuine, yeah, but we have that fear which sort of manifests in these kind of irrational things like the sort of conspiracy theories and so on. There's enough dangers in the world that are quite obvious without having to worry about conspiracies and prophecies and all of these kinds of things. So this is this kind of dual relationship we have with change. On the one hand, we like the new things, we like the technological developments, we get genuine satisfaction out of them, and yet at the same time, it brings with us a sense of foreboding, a sense of fear, a sense of breakdown. And so in Buddhism, it's helpful to reflect in Buddhism on the notion of how we respond to that is the notion of through kind of an interplay or between continuity and change. See, when the Buddha said that everything is impermanent, he didn't mean, of course, that everything changes radically from one moment to the next. Okay? That's not what impermanence means. It doesn't mean that everything just disappears and starts again. Right? What impermanence means is that the nature of things is to arise and fall. Okay, the nature of them, their dhamma, is to arise and fall. So one of the stories Ajahn Chah gave, he said, someone asked him, what's right view? And Ajahn Chah said, you see this cup? It's broken already. Some people are nodding. That means that they understand. Is that good? It's broken already. It means it's the nature of things to be impermanent, yeah? And that's what understanding impermanence and understanding change is, yeah? It's not just seeing things when they finish or when they break up, but you have to understand it's the nature of this to change. And this is what the Buddha said is the difference between a foolish person and a wise person is that whenever something good happens to a foolish person, right, that they will rejoice in it. Yeah, if they get a good food, yeah, or good robes, or if they fall in love, or if they have a new baby or something like that, they will rejoice in it unconditionally. Yeah. And without thinking, without reflecting on it, when that moment happens, they're completely taken up in that, and they want it to continue forever. You want to hold on to that. You want to hold on to that moment forever. You know, when I was staying at this forest monastery in Thailand, we had this delightful old Lungpo I was staying with for a while. Very kind of simple old Thai monk. And I used to tease him sometimes when we had really good weather in the monastery, you know, sometimes in the cold season in Thailand, it would be beautiful day and it's sort of clear and still and just perfect temperature. And I'd say, oh, Lungpo, such a great day today. If only it could be like this forever. And he'd say, oh, I cannot. It's got to change. Oh, really? Okay. So this is what we don't reflect, yeah? We get infatuated, yeah? That moment of perfection of things. You know, and you can see that one of the nice ways of seeing that is in food, you know, because the food goes through this whole incredible process, you know, being you know, the seeds in the soil and then sprouting out and then the wheat and then it's getting harvested and then it's getting transported and it's getting processed and it's getting cooked. And all of that time, yeah, it's not particularly delicious. Yeah? And then it gets put on the plate and brought and put in front of you. And that moment, it's delicious. Yeah? As soon as you've taken one bite out of it, it's not delicious anymore. Yeah? It's that, just that moment when it's actually presented in front of you, before you've taken anything from it, that everything comes together. Yeah? And then you eat it, and then you swallow it down, digest it, excrete it, flush it down the sewerage. Yeah? All out, and then it goes into the water and so on, then gets put back on the fields, comes around again. Yeah? It keeps on going around. And it goes around and around in that cycle. And we just want to shut out that whole cycle and just focus on that one little moment. Yeah? And it's that little moment that, you know, when they advertise food, they photograph that, don't they? You take a photo of that one moment, but it's actually not even that moment, because like the art of food photography is actually a very sophisticated science. Like the food that they actually photograph is completely inedible, right? They have to spray it with all kinds of glosses and varnishes and all of these things and put stuff to make it actually look like they want it to look. It's not real food, yeah? And it's just capturing that moment, that one moment, and holding that in eternity. Yeah. So that's what we want to do. That's what we'd like to do. Capture that moment of perfection and hold it in eternity. And that is what the Buddha said that foolish and ignorant people do. What does that tell us about us? But a noble one reflects. Yeah, this too is impermanent. Yeah, this too will pass. This too is a conditioned phenomena. This too has come out of causes and conditions. It's here for a time and it will pass away. Yeah? That's all. Yeah? That's very simple and very, very profound. That's truly the wisdom of the noble ones. When something good happens, you get something new happens, some food, whatever happens, even if you have a new baby, yeah? Most beautiful thing in the world to have a new baby. There's so much love that you feel for this baby. And you reflect, this baby too is conditioned. He will grow old, he'll get sick, he will die. Nothing you can do about it. Yeah? And so if you reflect like that, then that takes the edge off change. Yeah? And it's not about not having those moments, okay? So it's not about not enjoying those moments of pleasure which the world gives you, yeah? That's not the purpose. The purpose is just to put that in some context so you don't get too infatuated by it, yeah? And when you have that sense of reflection about it, then the joys in life will not get you too infatuated, too addicted. And the pain and the suffering that comes will not get you too upset. You'll be able to recover from those things much more easily. And so that's something you need to train yourself in. And we need to train ourselves in repeatedly, consistently. Yeah. So this is one of the one of the benefits of meditation. Okay, so when we do meditation practice, in a sense, we've got a microcosm of the real world right there in our meditation. You sit there, you go inside your mind, and in there you find everything that exists outside. Okay, so your whole life, your whole emotional life, all your thoughts, ideas, feelings, everything that you felt in every situation through your life, you'll find them inside your meditation somewhere. Sooner or later. The good ones, the bad ones, yeah, the peaceful ones, the agitated ones, even more so, they'll become even more vivid, more intense. It's all there. All of life is inside there. And when you meditate, remember how I was teaching at the start of that guided meditation to just sort of step back a little bit and just watch. Yeah? So you watch the thoughts coming and going. You watch the feelings coming and going. Watch the emotions coming and going. You watch the sensations in different parts of the body coming and going. Yeah? And as you watch those things, you're continually reminding yourself that these are all impermanent. They're all impermanent. Actually, this is the great lesson that life is teaching us all the time. Every moment of the day, our eyes are teaching us. Everything we see is impermanent. Our eyes are teaching it. You're sitting there right now. You're looking. Your eyes are teaching you. What you're seeing is impermanent. Your ears. What's coming through your ears? Is impermanent. It's changing all the time. The smell, taste, touch. All of these things are teaching you all of the time. It's impermanent. It's impermanent. It's whispering. You know, like they say in the Pure Land, that when you die, you know, you go to the Pure Land, and then when you're there, that the teachings, the Dhamma, will be like whispered on the wind. Yeah, so coming out. Well, it's like the kind of the music coming in the escalators or something like that, and be teaching you the Dhamma all the time. But that's not a description of the Pure Land. That's a description of here. That's a description of this land. Yeah? The Dhamma is already being taught to you all the time. It's impermanent. What more lessons do you want? Every moment you've been alive, since the first time you started crying as a baby, up until the day that you die, everything you've ever known is impermanent. Yeah? Every thought you've ever had is impermanent. Every feeling you've ever had, every idea you've ever had, every concept is impermanent. What what more lesson do you want? Yeah? What more lesson do you want than life itself? So in the understanding of that impermanence, we can accept that impermanence when we have a feeling of confidence and togetherness within ourselves. And this is something that I've notice, and that I've had to learn very slowly and painfully in trying to run a monastery, is that I personally have quite a high tolerance for uncertainty. Yeah, and I don't know whether that's something was in my life even long before I was a monk, and I think really the reason for that is because I had a very secure upbringing. And I had a very safe upbringing, and I was very nurturing, and I didn't have the life lessons from having a dysfunctional family, right?
I didn't have the disadvantage of having a traumatic childhood. So I was brought up with everything very safe, and so I tend to have a lot of tolerance for uncertainty. Whereas I've noticed that people who didn't have that, people who did have abusive childhoods or traumatic upbringings, yeah, that for them it's very difficult to tolerate uncertainty and to tolerate change. They get extremely stressed out about it. Which, of course, is very difficult for us in a monastery because we're trying to build a monastery. So you can't build a monastery without changing things. Yeah? But for some people, change itself is very stressful. So this is that once we understand that, we understand that the greater the sense of security and confidence we have within ourselves, then the more we're able to accept change and uncertainty. So this is why in Buddhist meditation you always have the balance of samatha and vipassana, the balance of tranquility and insight. Okay, so tranquility or samatha meditation is what we do when we're focusing on developing those qualities of evenness, steadiness, coolness, joy, happiness, wholeness, oneness of heart. Okay, so like we were doing when we were doing the metta meditation earlier. All those qualities we're trying to develop. Now when we're focusing on developing those, that's what we call samatha meditation. And when we're focusing on developing insight, discernment, understanding, understanding of conditionality, of impermanence, of not self, of emptiness, of suffering, when we're focusing on developing those things, we call that vipassana or insight meditation. So, of course, both of those things, the Buddha said, should be a pair. Okay, so they're a pair which are developed in balance and in harmony. Now, if we develop vipassana, insight meditation, too much, without enough grounding in samatha, without a sufficient sense of emotional wholeness and security, then it can be quite, you can get freaked out by it actually. You can get a great sense of fear. You feel like everything's breaking up. The whole world's breaking up and disappearing. It's because it is. Yeah? And if you have that perception, if it's too vivid, then you can create a lot of fear and a lot of disturbance, yeah? Because you're seeing reality too sharply. Yeah? It's like you're looking into the sun that's too bright, yeah? And so you're not yet ready for that degree of wisdom or that degree of insight. So if that's happening, then you need to come over and develop more samatha. Okay, don't worry about watching impermanence and change. Just develop that sense of tranquility and ease and happiness and joy and so on and so forth, all those things. And when the heart is big and it's strong and it's stable, then you're ready to come, you can do some more vipassana and you can accept those truths at a very deep level. Right? So it's very important to manage that balance of samatha and vipassana, and the same thing happens. There's the same thing in your meditation and the same thing in life outside of meditation as well. If you are finding that your life is too stressful, there's too much demands, it's too much change happening, then you need to also emphasize the continuity. And so this is a very important principle. Don't just get freaked out by the change, but come back and say, well, what that's showing me is that the level of change is too much and I need to emphasize continuity. So that continuity you could do through meditation, through developing samatha meditation, making the mind peaceful, but also through other aspects of your life as well, like say cultural aspects or say family. So for example, family is something which generally speaking remains stable for us, yeah? Through our lives, relatively stable. So when, you know, if you feel like work is the changes and so on that's happening through work and so on, well, spend some time with your family, yeah? And then that reminds you of those things which remain constant in life. Yeah? That's one of the things you can do. or else go to some nature, because nature is timeless. Yeah? Technology is changing all the time. Nature is timeless. Of course, nature has her own rhythms as well, yeah. But those rhythms are the primordial rhythms, the cycles of the seasons and the day and the night and so on. And that's very soothing. Yeah. So again, this is one of the reasons why we feel comforted when we go to a park or we go to the ocean or something like that. It has that kind of comforting and soothing effect. Or else, sort of cultural continuity also is important. So, for example, something like Buddhism. Yeah? So Buddhism is something which is very old. Yeah? And so it's got that cultural connection, 2,500 years. So when we engage in Buddhist practices, we can reflect that we're doing the same thing. It's being passed down generation after generation after generation. We do the chanting in Pali. It's been done for more than 2,000 years. You think about that. The chanting that we did, little bit of chanting we did before the talk today, it's been done like that for 2,000 years or more. And so that's reminding us of a sort of a deeper aspect of our culture, which keeps a continuity in the face of change. So all of these are things which help us to cope when we feel threatened by the pace of change. But of course, you see those things not as a denial of change, right? It's not, you're not trying to escape from change, you're not trying to pretend that change doesn't happen or to stop it from happening, which is, I'm afraid, is a lot of people in Buddhism seem to want to do, is just come to Buddhism and they tell you everything's impermanent, but then they, except Buddhism, right? Buddhism is the only thing that's permanent and stays exactly the same all the time. I won't get into that anyway. It's one of my favorite bugbears. But anyway, so we're not trying to deny it. What we're trying to do is just to recognize that there are the cycles, and that if we're in that space of change and stress, then we need a refuge. We need also to find a place of stillness. And from that place of stillness, we then reflect that the change is inevitable. So when we come back and we're experiencing the change again, then we don't get caught up in it too much. Neither in pushing forward to go to the future, to get, you know, to always encourage that or get infatuated with that, that they're always having the newest or the latest or whatever, and nor being afraid by it. Being pressured or made tense by the changes that are coming. So this is a few reflections for you this evening on managing change. So I offer that to you for your amusement. And does anyone have any comments or questions or reflections? Or if you don't have any comments or questions, maybe if anyone's got any good jokes they could share with us.
So you say sadhu, sadhu three times to Ajahn. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So any questions from the floor? A silence, no change. Ajahn, there's a question regarding the this financial crisis. I think most people they have their bank account, their investment all reduced by more than half, even including myself. So how you suggest to these type of people who, you know, cope with this type of sudden change in their financial, the account which they have before, and now suddenly you reduced, right, by more than half. Yeah. So, Of course, it's not to zero, but at least, you know, still has a certain percentage.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like there may be some attachment there. But that's the name of the game, isn't it? You know, and again, it's just a thing of attachment. You know, I did economics at school, and first lesson number one in economics is you have a boom and then you have a bust. Yeah, and that's what we're told. And the higher the boom goes, the bigger the crash. And if we're not aware of that and don't pay attention to it, then, you know, that's really our responsibility. We should be aware that this is going to happen. And the more we try to be greedy, the more we try to get too much, yeah, for our returns, then the bigger the crash will come. So not making a personal comment there about you, but the value of money goes up and down according to these inscrutable market forces. And actually, interestingly enough, in the most recent crash, one of the reasons why it happened so suddenly, so I read an article, they're saying that more than half of all the financial transactions now are actually done by computers. So there's no human involvement in them at all. Right? It's just computers trading shares with computers. And so when that happens, so the first thing you do is you reflect, well, that's just what happens. Yeah, money goes up in value and it goes down in value. You reflect, you think back, what did I feel like, right, when all the money was piling up in my bank account? Yeah? And did you reflect at that time, this is impermanent, yeah? This isn't going to bring me real happiness, yeah? Or did you look at it and think, oh, river, yeah? Another 10,000, yeah, another this, another that. Yeah? Did you reflect on that? So remember that when you reflect, when the times are good, that's the time when you need to reflect. And then, okay, when it goes bad, then it won't hurt so badly. But, you know, also remember that the bad times won't last forever either. Yeah? The bad times will also come good.
This is meant to be a joke. I would suggest that you donate the other half to Buddhist fellowship, so the next bus you will not be affected.